I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy who's always had an interest in effective pharmacy leadership. Our purpose in this conversation with successful leaders is to hear in their own words about their career, the lessons that they've learned, so it may benefit us. Remember that pharmacy is very different than being a leader. As a brief review of Mary Jo Riley's career, she received her pharmacy degree in 1959 and her master's in 1962 from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She practiced at Mercy Hospital as a resident, as a staff pharmacist, and then as an assistant director. She progressed her leadership career to ASHP, where she was a staff writer for the American Hospital Formulary Service, its editor, a senior VP at ASHP, and culminated her career as the chief operating officer, the number two person on the staff of ASHP. Welcome, Dr. Mary Jo Riley.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
One of the things that all of us deal with, especially in healthcare today, is change. As chief operating officer, the number two for ASHP, you've had some experience in managing changes. The thing I remember the most about you is you relocated the entire staff from one building to another building. Would you comment a bit on your planning around that and the things you did to try to help all of the staff, because it really affected every staff person? And by the way, roughly how many staff did that affect at that point in time?
I think when we moved from 4630 Montgomery Avenue to 7072 Wisconsin Avenue, we were about 150, plus or minus a few. Mm-hmm. To look at ASHP's move and buildings, and you have to realize how critical a decision it was when we bought 4630 Montgomery Avenue, and then an even bigger one when we made the decision to purchase the Wisconsin Avenue building, because we were in a new line of business. We were in the real estate business. We did not fully occupy, as an ASHP staff, either one of those buildings, so we had to find tenants, and the decision process that went into making the purchases was something that was quite drawn out, very thoughtful, involved the ASHP staff, the board of directors, and when we finally made that decision, everyone said this had better be a good thing, because we've really put a lot of effort into just making the decision to purchase the building. When we went from 4630 to 7272, we were moving into a new building that was empty. There were no walls up anyplace. So we had to design the space from the ground up. And again, we went to the corporate staff and we went to the board and we showed them what it was going to look like. And the longer that process went on, the more Joe Otis's eyes began to glaze over, because he had made the big decision, we're going to buy the building, now let's get going, let's get the move on. And he asked me if I would like to be in charge of that. And I was so egotistical at the time that I thought that would just be a great thing to do. In fact, I always said I wanted Peter Ueberroth's job organizing the LA Olympics, because I just felt that I could organize anything. It was going to be a picnic to get people into 7272. Wrong. We started from day one keeping the staff informed about what was going on. Communication was critical. In the beginning, while they were putting the walls up, I had a memo maybe once a month. Then it got to be once a week, and the closer we got, it was almost daily as we kept people informed. I had floor captains. I was going to share this blame as much as I possibly could. I had people in key areas who were part of the team, and those people had even more memos, more meetings and more discussions. we worked with a very wonderful interior design person who got to know us very well and appreciated what we were trying to do by involving people, but not involving them too much. The day that we moved, the weekend that we moved, we had, well, over several months, we had been telling people, clean out your files, you know, all of those things that you do when you move your home. Then we came to the critical weekend, and we put boxes in people's offices, and I believe it was a Friday morning, we said, pack up your office, and when you're packed, you can go home. And people didn't want to go home. They wanted to hang around and see what was going on. They had had a couple of tours of the building, but we really had to keep them out because we were trying to do things like run cable to install computers, restart the Xerox machines, get the telephone system up, all that infrastructure that was going on. I would say we probably did it in the shortest possible time. When people came in on Monday morning, we had our team captains in wild yellow tour guide t-shirts that met people at the elevator and took them to their office. People unpacked their boxes, and by noon we were operational, so we didn't miss very much time at all. But I would have to say that the communications was the biggest thing, and lesson learned.
Another thing that people are constantly dealing with is innovation, and one of the things I remember that you were instrumental in is the development of Advantage. And could you talk about how that came about, what it is, and sort of what it's doing and things like that?
Well, to go back in history, one of the reasons that we started the mid-year clinical meeting was to help improve our relationship with the pharmaceutical industry. We were trying to get them to do unit dose. We were trying to get them to be forthcoming with drug information. So we started the mid-year clinical meeting to improve our relationship with the industry, among other things, and that worked very well. We had a very successful exhibit program. Many other pharmacy associations have their sessions sponsored by the industry, and we never did that. We always maintained through our educational services division the content of all of our continuing education programs and just drained our members dry having them create those sessions for us. They came right from the practitioners. But the industry still wanted to have some programs, so we started the exhibitors theaters in the middle of the day and allowed the industry to put on their sessions during that time block when we had no competing continuing education programs. Then we got to the point where the industry was asking if ASHP would plan their exhibit program for them. Well, we had quite enough on our plate, thank you. But we realized that there was an opportunity to do things for the industry that could generate some income for ASHP. We did not want to do that through our educational services division, so we had a little staff committee that I chaired, and we had representatives from the journal and the educational services, the marketing people, and we spent about 6 months looking into what might we be able to do to capture some of that industry funding that would not taint our own programs. And we came up with the idea of having a separate activity, which we called ASHP Advantage, where we would do continuing education under contract with the industry for a nice, tidy sum. Since we started just with the educational sessions as the about 10, 12 years old now, I guess, Advantage is. They have their own continuing education accreditation process. They have done videotapes. They do focus groups. They have the continuing education now on their website. So they've expanded to do a lot of things that the industry used to do for themselves, but the industry likes to have that little link with ASHP. So that has been a very successful activity. And we have two people who have been running that from the beginning. And they are two very energetic practitioners who were on the ASHP staff, who had past experience in the industry, so they had a little idea about how the industry thinks, what will appeal to industry, how to, can you deal with the industry representatives. And best of all, they love ASHP. They would not want to do anything that would taint ASHP in any way, but will go to the ends of the earth to develop projects that ASHP Advantage can be associated with, generating the income that then goes to ASHP and allows us to provide, you notice I still say us, allows us to provide services that cost money, but that we don't charge for.
Well, an Advantage, as you said, has been very successful. I think recently they now can provide medical education accredited and I think
yes.
nursing, so they've expanded in that.
Yes.
But you're correct about the leaders of that and how critical they were
yes.
to really the success of it.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about some of their personalities, because you've mentioned they're enthusiastic, but
yeah.
drill down
yeah.
a little bit about what a successful leader is in your view, having watched some of that.
Yeah. Well, we certainly had had two in Advantage and many others on ASHP staff. And there are many different styles among the ASHP staff, all effective. The Advantage folks, as I say, have a passion for what mm-hmm. they do.
Okay.
Their foundation was ASHP. And they believed in what they were doing. They were part of the group that helped to develop the plan. They had a lot of input.
Mm-hmm.
Looking into their past, they recognized that there were things that they knew from their past experiences that could help us.
Mm-hmm.
They're very pleasant people. It's really hard to get them down. They've got big proposals that they have to get done, and they just laugh a lot. They're on the phone constantly. But they both drive Porsches now, and I think that must tell something about their personalities. They're Porsche people.
For a number of years, you directed the executive residency program at ASHP. Could you comment on how that program was important from your vantage point?
When we initially started the residency program, it was under Accreditation Services. Warren McConnell was the preceptor because it was a residency, and he was the residency guy. But as years went on, we got to thinking we shouldn't have so much emphasis in the accreditation and continuing education area. We should really probably run this out of the executive office. So I was given the opportunity of becoming the mentor for the executive residents. And I think I had maybe 17 or 18 while I was on the staff. They usually come to us through a competitive process and have to withstand the interviews. And most of them say they want to be association executives. after their year with us. Many did go into association work. Some stayed with us. One of the reasons we did it was to provide leadership for our state chapters. Mm-hmm. And we've had a half a dozen that have gone to become directors or on the staff of some of our local chapters, or even the state pharmaceutical association chapters. Our best residents were just like sponges. They wanted to know everything. They helped us as much as we helped them, I'm sure. You have experience with residents, you know what they do. They question everything you do. You have to explain why you do it that way. And it made us re-examine many things that that we did. I would say that of all of our residents, there are only maybe two or three that are in practice, traditional practice. Most of them have either gone into business for themselves, they're with other associations, or they're doing sort of what you would look at as non-traditional things within pharmacy. Mm-hmm. They are exceptional young people, and I'm very proud of all of them. They love each other. They network all the time. Someone's up for a new job, he or she calls three or four of the other residents to find out what they think about that kind of a move. We've had a couple of reunions where we all get together. We had one over in on the Maryland Eastern Shore, and I'm not sure Eastern Maryland was really ready for the ASHP executive residency reunion, but we had a great time. And then we had one in Pittsburgh, and several of the residents have businesses similar to ASHP Advantage, for example. Many of them do contract work with ASHP. They still want to maintain that connection with ASHP, even though they've gone on to not be your traditional institutional practitioners.
And I would agree with you. It really is a two-way street, being a preceptor, and you do learn probably more sometimes than the residents. Yeah. Talk a little bit about what your approach was. You said they were a sponge, and I think that's probably the most successful type, but then how did you feed that sponge? Let me put it that way.
Well, my door was always open. In all my years at ASHP, I don't think I ever closed a door. Sometimes I didn't have a door to close, but if I had one to close, I didn't close it. George Provo always said, my door is always open, knock on it any time. But we had a very open relationship. I would meet with them about every other morning at 9:30. We'd get together and look at what was coming up. Now, while I mentored them, they did work in other, rotated through all the other operations of ASHP. But we would have a little pre-discussion about, there were actually two kinds of residents. Those who wanted to know when they were going into Sarah White's area, what was Sarah White like? And then there were those who didn't want to know, wanted to try to figure it out for him or herself, and then we would talk about it later. Before a corporate staff meeting where a big decision was going to be made, we would get together and we would try to figure out who was going to vote for and who was going to vote against and why. And then we would go to the corporate staff meeting, and we got to be pretty good at figuring out how people were going to react to things, and then we would talk about it afterwards.
In 1984, your efforts were recognized by the prestigious Harvey A. K. Whitney Lecture Award. How did you feel about receiving that recognition?
I couldn't believe it, first off. As a staff person, you don't really think about being recognized for anything individually, because much of what you do is in the background, and our task is to do what the members would like. and to not be looking for credit. And you think first of all about all the people who helped get you there, all of the staff people that make it possible for whatever recognition you might receive while you're out doing that. As you well know, somebody's home doing the work. And of course you think about your parents and teachers and schooling that got you to that point. And then the frustrating thing is when you give the Whitney address, you're not really able to thank all of those people because you would be there spending the whole address thanking people. So it's a very humbling experience when you look through that list of past recipients and you see your name. It's something that stays with you for a long time.
Think about the people who influenced you throughout your career and tell us a little bit about how they influenced you or helped you, might be another way to think of it.
Well, I guess I would have to start with my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. My mom always said she had been a school teacher. Interestingly enough, she caught commercial subjects, typing and shorthand. And when she got married, she wasn't able to teach anymore because married women could not teach in those days. But she always said, start on the very first day and do your very best. That start on the very first day translated through the years to get a good foundation. Know what it is that you're talking about and what it is that you're doing. When my dad and I would play ball, he would always say, I was the oldest girl, he had no boys, so he had to teach me to play ball. And he would say, keep your eye on the ball, keep your eye on the ball. And through the years, that is a very important thing to remember. Always look at what it is you're trying to achieve. Keep your eye on the ball, don't be worried about the things on either side. Keep your eye on the goal. I had a teacher that taught English in 8th grade and 10th grade and worked on my writing skills, so I would give her credit for influencing me and making me like to write. So many people do not like to write, did not like to write. Of course, John Adams at Duquesne University was the dean when our class came in, and it was his first year as dean, so he had a special interest in us. We were his kids, and he pulled out two or three of us that he provided with little extra opportunities here and there, the opportunity to have lunch with Don and Gloria when they came to the university to speak to the student APHA, things of that sort. So he was always very encouraging and encouraged me to go to graduate school. And as I was graduating, Mercy Hospital was starting up their residency, formalizing the residency as part of a master's program at Duquesne University, and that was the direction I went. Sister Gonzalez influenced everyone she came in contact with. She used to always say, anything that we can do better. So she taught me to look at processes and try to find a better way to accomplish something. Joe Otis, when I went to ASHP, I felt that I knew Joe somewhat before I went there because of his connection with Mercy Hospital and Sister Gonzalez. And I had visited Joe and Jean in their home in Chicago in Downers Grove. So I always felt that Joe and Jean were my family in Washington. And with Joe, once again, we were back to keep your eye on the ball. He always had the goal in mind. He was the best delegator that I have ever known. He would give you a job. You tell him what tools you need to get the job done, report back to him periodically. That was key. he liked to know what was going on. He didn't want you to just run away with something. He wanted to know the status, especially on big new activities, because he would be asked by members of the board and by members, and he didn't ever want to be surprised by something. So learning to work with him, taking the delegated work and keeping him in the loop was something that was a really good learning experience. And I give him a lot of credit for managing that whole great big staff and not getting bogged down in the details, because he kept his eye on the ball.
Think back over your career. Are there some lessons that you wish you had learned earlier rather than later?
Yes, I guess the one lesson that I learned at the time when I was working with the residents was, and I used to tell them this, and then I realized that for a lot of years I didn't realize it myself, and that is that you have to realize nobody thinks like you do. You have just the absolute best idea, and everyone looks at you like, oh, where did that come from? And assume nothing. I think if I had learned that a little earlier, a few things might have been easier. But you have to be prepared. That old Girl Scout motto, you know. I was a Girl Scout too, but I guess be prepared is one of those things that you have to remember. We spend, I used to tell the residents, in fact, I had some buttons on that. I guess I've been big on buttons, I don't know. I had buttons made up, found them someplace that said, we spend most of our lives in Plan B. Sometimes people get a real firm idea of a career direction. They're going to go here, and then they're going to go there, and then that'll lead to this. Have to keep your mind and your heart open to opportunities that come along. Don't be so rigid that you have to stick to Plan A. There's some really good stuff in Plan B.
Yes, because you could miss opportunities.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell us a bit about, as you were a high school student, what you were leaning on in terms of career-wise and how you sort of ended up in pharmacy and then in hospital practice.
I was very interested in writing when I was in school. We had our little newspaper, and I did the newspaper and things of that sort. Won a couple of essay contests. So I thought journalism would probably be a pretty good field for me. In our high school, we had vocational training, commercial training, and then general studies, and I was a general studies person. But even of the general studies, people, not a whole lot of them went to college. I was one of the fortunate ones who did. $12 a credit, I believe it was, at Duquesne University when I started. I had a friend who was going to go to pharmacy school at Purdue, and she had her brochures about pharmacy, and I was looking through her brochures. And somewhere on the back page, it had a list of opportunities if you had a pharmacy degree. And one of them was pharmaceutical journalism. You could work for the industry, and you could do all these wonderful things. And I thought, that's not such a bad deal. And back in those days, I think it was always, if you're good in chemistry, you can go into pharmacy school. So instead of applying to journalism at Duquesne, I applied to pharmacy school. And the rest is history. I was a good student, and therefore, when I had completed the 4 years, we were the last of the four-year class. When I had completed the 4 years, John Adams encouraged me to go to graduate school. And I had worked in a drugstore, getting in my 13 weeks every summer, learning how to run a cash register and all those important things that you had to do to internship before you could take the state boards. And I knew I did not want to go into retail practice. I had sold enough Buxton wallets and Cody powder and those sorts of things. So the idea of doing hospital was of interest to me. And in fact, during my senior year, I went down to the hospital, and Sister always was looking for volunteers to punch capsules or deliver carts or something. So I had worked there for 6 months or so, and thought that hospital was much more attractive than the retail end of things. So I went into that master's program.
And so doing your residency then at Mercy in Pittsburgh,
yes,
in the early 60s, I think, what did pharmacists do in the early 60s in hospitals?
Mm-hmm. Well, we would come into work in the morning, and outside the pharmacy there was a ledge, and on that ledge would be big tin baskets that had come down from each of the floors. And in the basket was a list of things that each unit needed for floor stock. And it was such things as a mouthwash and back rub and aspirin and those items that were not prescription items. So the first thing we did was fill the drug baskets. We filled all those orders and put them back on the ledge. And at 9 o'clock, somebody would come down from the nursing unit and pick up their basket. We had a courier who went around and picked up the prescription orders, new drug orders, and refills had been ordered during the night, first thing in the morning. And those, they came down in a paper bag. And the paper bags were lined up on a counter. And after we had had our cup of coffee, we would go and fill those orders from the floors. The courier would take those back, and maybe there had been some new orders written. Through the day, there was a cycle of bags coming and going. Now, we had a compounding area where we made things that were commercially available, as well as special formulations that were used by physicians in our hospital. And at Mercy Hospital, we also had sterile products. We did large volume parenterals, and we did small volume. We made our own Demerol and morphine and injectables, as well as dextrose solutions and saline solutions and those sorts of things. The pharmacy was open from 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the evening, but there was always someone on call from 5 o'clock in the evening until the next morning, that being me. As a resident, I lived in the the nurse quarters, and was on call through the night. The night supervisor would came to, if something interesting came in, an interesting case, she came to know that I might be interested in seeing it. So she would call me, sometimes get me out of a sound sleep, and I would go and make rounds with her frequently, and you would learn, again, a little bit of what we were then not calling clinical, but 3 years later we were.
Having been on the ASHP staff for the majority of your career, in your view, what's the purpose of a professional organization?
I've always felt that a professional organization should do for its members those things that members can't do for themselves. And if you have that as the primary goal, many other things are enabled. The advocacy that you do, members can't speak with any force. They're one person. but as an association representing 25, 30,000 people, when you approach the industry or the legislators, doing publications, everybody needs this information, but everybody can't do it individually. The formulary, for example, was published by the society because individual hospitals had formularies, drug lists, but they couldn't all generate comparative and evaluative information about every drug. When we look at the various membership groups, they told us what they needed in one way or another. So we tried to do, as a professional association, those things that members can't do for themselves.
Let's talk a little bit about how a professional organization, specifically ASHP, has the members help with assessing the priorities and establishing the direction, because the way in which ASHP does this is fairly typical of professional organizations. Maybe the place to start is by you describing the purpose of ASHP councils.
Mm-hmm. ASHP, in order to do what members need to have done, have to have some way of collecting that information. We do it by traveling to individual hospitals, traveling to chapter meetings, talking with members. But there are some formal ways that we do it as well. We have ASHP. When I was there, there were five councils. I think those have been juggled and changed, but let's just say a generic council in different subject areas, one in legal, one in professional, one in education, one in membership services. Those councils are made up of members who are appointed by the president, generally because an affiliated chapter has suggested them or board or officers have met them. But there are 10 people on a council, 10 members on a council. And toward my later years at ASHP, we also had a student member, and now I think they might also have a resident member. They try to get good geographic representation. So if you have five or six councils, you're involving 50, 60 members, maybe a few more. And those councils meet at least once a year, sometimes more often. Sometimes they had telephone conference calls. Those councils meet and discuss what are the issues within their particular subject areas. And they make recommendations. Those recommendations go to the board. And there are some that the board says, yes, this is a good idea, let's do it. There are some that require that a higher authority also look to see whether or not it's a high enough priority to devote society resources to it. And those then would go to our House of Delegates. And the House of Delegates is made up of members, apportioned according to ASHP membership within a state. So a small state might have just two delegates, a larger one, I don't know how many California had, 10 maybe. And those same issues that had bubbled up through the councils would go to the House of Delegates, and the House would debate them and say yes, no, or maybe. Sometimes they sent them back for more study. From the staff perspective, after each of those council meetings and after the House meetings, we had a list of all the things that had come out of the councils. Mm-hmm. And that list was quite extensive. Sometimes might be 50 or 60 things on there that needed to be addressed in one way or another. And there was a staff group called then the Policy Implementation Group. We would meet and look at every one of those recommendations and say, how can we address this? Do we need to refer it to publications? Do we need to go up on Capitol Hill and storm the halls of Congress? What do we need to respond to this need that has been identified? Mm-hmm. And that policy implementation group met 4 or 5 times a year so that you didn't just get it on your plate and leave it there. You had to report back to the status of it within a reasonable period of time.
In 1981, you moved from editing the formulary service into a senior VP and then later into a COO position. So those were career moves, even though they were within ASHP. They were significantly changed responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how you viewed career moves and the risk associated, maybe why those were attractive to you.
Well, I've said before that I was with ASHP for 37 years. And no 2 days were ever the same. I was there during that tremendous growth curve. We were growing in membership. We were being asked to do more and more things for the members. And we were starting more and more services. At one point, we started what we called special publications, because we didn't know what else to call it, where we repurposed material that had been already published in IPA or the formulary or the journal, and we would publish a therapeutic category specific book, for example. And then we had members who came to us. The first was a technician manual, and I forget the young man's name now, but his wife was sick of filling orders out of her basement for his technician manual. It was a programmed learning book, and he had given a paper at a meeting, and suddenly everybody wanted a copy, and he had some printed up and was sending them out to people from his home, and he came to us and said, I don't want to keep doing this. Why don't you folks do it? We did. Well, that gave us another idea. If there's one book out there like that, maybe there are some others. Some we generated ourselves. Some we took a handbook on injectable drugs, for example. One of our most successful publications over the years was started off as a little manual that Larry Trissel did for the folks at NIH, and it grew and grew and grew. We took that over. Since Larry didn't have to worry about the selling and the printing, he was able to provide content much better than he would have had he been doing it all himself. He probably would have burned out on that little idea long ago. So I always looked at these new things as there's an opportunity here. There are some processes that need to be applied. I loved doing the continuing education things, because again, we had a mid-year meeting that was growing so fast. One year you have 5,000 attendees, and the next year you have 8. One year you have 50 submitted posters, and the next year you have 500. You have to do something to make that operation run smoothly. And I always felt that that sort of thing was my strength. So when I had the opportunity to take over that area of responsibility and have some very good people reporting to me, I always had the utmost respect for Max Ray, and Max was the accreditation services person, and he was a report to me. We had to start a marketing department. We had all these special publications. We had IPA, we had the formulary, we had the journal. We needed marketing. That was a pretty nasty word for a professional organization to deal in marketing. That was not nearly pure enough for a professional organization. But fortunately, right around that same time, competition among hospitals became pretty tight. And hospitals were starting marketing departments. So that helped us to move, transition into having a marketing division, and to really give serious consideration to how we were going to handle our many projects and activities. And so I also had marketing for a while. I think while I was at ASHP, I think at one time or another, everything except finance and law reported to me in one way or another. And I think maybe legal I could have handled, but the finance was not my strong point. I had to rely quite heavily. I managed to submit a budget and to keep to it, but finance was not one of my strengths, although we generated quite a bit of income through the things that I managed.
As the senior VP and chief operating officer, you had a number of direct reports. Talk a little bit about your philosophy of how to work with direct reports.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tried to take my cues from Joe Otis. I gave people pretty much free rein. I had weekly meetings, status report. I was not real big on memos and written reports. Each of the divisions had a weekly meeting, and sometimes I would go to those meetings to shore up the direct report and get a flavor of what was happening within those divisions. But I pretty well and was fortunate to be able to rely on those folks, touching base with them when needed. And we had a weekly division directors meeting. We had a weekly corporate staff meeting. So we emphasized communication, communication, communication. The biggest communication gap was probably between management and the staff people who were pharmacists, who wanted to know. They were ASHP members, they worked for ASHP, they wanted to know everything that was going on. And it was very difficult to get an IPA abstractor, for example, up to speed on everything that was going on in ASHP. But we tried there too. We rotated those folks to annual and mid-year meetings so they got out and could see members, could see what the meetings were like. We involved them in staff committees. But I think in communicating, when you've got a couple hundred people down to the very staff level, was the biggest challenge. And I don't know if we ever completely had solved it, but we did have to work on that, because they were pharmacists, and it was their organization too, and they were often asked questions by friends and members about something ASHP was doing, and they had not a clue because it wasn't in their area.
When a direct report had a problem and they came to you, did you feel like as their manager you needed to solve that problem for them?
No. I spent probably a lot of time reviewing how we got the problem in the first place. Go back to the foundation. Where did we slip up? And what is it that we are really trying to achieve here? Keep your eye on the ball. Because sometimes the problem really was not as serious as it looked. And if we went back and reviewed and projected a little bit, maybe we had to call in some help from someplace else. But yeah, we had to do that once in a while. But a dictatorship is the most efficient form of government. And I could probably have solved it with the snap of my fingers. But that doesn't work that way. Sometimes you just have to spend a lot of time until you get somebody else to see what the solution is. And they would know much better because it probably involved people in their area too.
What do you think the keys are to being a good listener for people?
Once when I, after I had left ASHP, I went back for some reason, and I was sitting in someone's office, and they were venting, and another staff member came in and said, you know, that's what we really miss you. We don't have anybody to vent to. And Stan Lowe said, you know what we should do? We should make a Mary Jo bobblehead, because I'm sitting here telling you all kinds of things, and all you're doing is saying, yep, yep. Sometimes all you have to do is listen. They're not looking for solutions. And I learned that, how valuable that can be when we have those after five adult beverage sessions at in the boardroom. Joe Otis always would invite anyone from the mailroom people to the senior vice president to come in and enjoy a beverage and chat. And many times that was a venting session because of something that had happened. And it's like Vegas. What happens in that room stayed in that room, but you felt so much better. So much of my listening was just listen. Maybe you ask a few questions. But if people vent long enough, I would find that they would sort of come around and figure it out for themselves.
You were never became the CEO of ASHP, the top position. Did you desire that?
No, I am not a top person. I have no vision whatsoever. I'm an implementer. I'm a process person. And I had been approached by another organization asking if I would be interested, and told them no. And it never entered my mind that I should be interested in the top ASHP position. There were other staff people who were, and I believe they interviewed. But that is not my cup of tea. I'm a much better second person, and I don't really know that I could be the visionary, the top guy.
So talk a little bit about your working relationship with Joe Otis, who was the CEO, because mm-hmm. as the number two, obviously you two worked very closely together, but talk a little bit about that relationship, the culture, and things like that.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I always felt that Joe and Gene were like family, and I never really looked at him as, wow, he's the boss. As I'm certain people who came on staff later, when we had 150 people, and he was the man, there were, I think, 12 people on staff when I came, and so we were all a family. And Joe and I always, he was always calling me the Irish girl. We always had a very nice, friendly relationship. And I don't ever remember having any cross words or any arguments with him that were uncomfortable. I could go in and make my case, and you have to be patient. You didn't get an answer right away, and sometimes you would have to nudge him along the next week. We never really had formal meetings, he and I. We did attend the corporate staff meetings together, and I felt at any time that I could go in and tell him what my problem was, if I had one. We really made that accommodation when Joe became so active in FIP that he knew he was going to be gone from the office a great deal. And he wanted the rest of the staff to not have to wait till he came home. There was never the excuse that we can't do something because Joe isn't here. So he gave me the authority to make decisions in the interim. And I always had to have a list of things. What did I do while he was gone? Although he was never gone for long, he made those trips very quickly. And I would meet with him when he came back and said, this came up, that came up, something. But we always were very much colleagues. There was not, in some instances, he deferred to my judgment, and in others, it was his.
So how did he support or back you up? I mean, if he wasn't a micromanager, did that mean that he never he wasn't involved in what you did, I guess? Maybe.
No, I think people knew that if I said it, I was saying it with his voice, mm-hmm. or he would say it and say, Mary Jo is going to follow through with this. He was always supportive and would had opportunities at like the corporate staff meetings and division meetings and what have you to speak with my voice and vice versa. We never really had a problem. People just knew that that's the way it was.
You were involved in developing and implementing one of the first sections on home care. And you might briefly talk a little bit about the SIGs and the SPIGs and the sections, just as an evolution of attempting to meet specific practitioner needs.
Yeah. Just as we had concern about managed care and nursing homes, and we had people suddenly that were involved in home care. And most of them were members of ASHP who either on their own as entrepreneurs or out of their institutions were providing home care services, and different regulations that they had to deal with, whole different relationship with patients. They had some special needs. And this group did not want to form a separate organization. They wanted ASHP to do it. We had 50 people on a council, on the councils, and perhaps among those 50 there might be one or two home care people. They had a hard time getting their message across. So again, we had a staff committee and we said, what can we do? And we had made up a long report that suggested we have what we were suggesting be called a section on home care, and that they be given certain rights and privileges, that they be allowed to elect their own leaders, that they be given a block of time to have meetings at the annual and mid-year meeting, that they could have a little publication, a newsletter-type publication, that they would have observer status at the House of Delegates and the privilege of the floor. That report went to corporate staff, from corporate staff to the board, was approved. And the home care people were very happy with it. We had a section on students. That was a student. If you joined ASHP as a student, you were automatically in the section. Didn't do anything any differently than we had ever done, but we called it the student section, which gives people an identity and a recognition. The dues didn't change. They had the same kinds of meetings at the sub-meetings at our meetings as they always had, but they were given identity. They were allowed to elect leaders was the only thing that was different. So I understand now, I haven't kept up with all of them, but I know there are a lot of other special groups like that that the society is trying to accommodate. And every one of them, you know, the more we can keep them within ASHP, the better it's going to be, not only for ASHP, but for them. It takes a long time to be able to build a staff of 200 people to serve your needs. And the ASHP staff is there and capable and ready to do those things for specialty groups. So let's bring them all on board. I say that because I'm not there now.
As you think back over your very successful career, what's been the most satisfying?
Of all the things that I did at ASHP, I know this sounds crazy, but I think the most satisfying thing that I ever did there was write formulary monographs, all the way back in the beginning. You would spend weeks on a monograph and send it out to be reviewed, thinking that you are the world's expert on drug X. But it would go to the manufacturer, would go to our review panel made up of physicians and practitioners who would comment on it, people who really knew about the drug, not just what you had been able to get from the literature. And those comments would come back, and the air would go out of your balloon, but you would take those comments and improve that monograph. And that final monograph then was used in a drug information source that practitioners, physicians, nurses, pharmacists relied on to actually treat patients. So the satisfaction, once that was in print, I think still is, goes back to my writing my drug information route there. But that was really the most satisfying long term.